I want to begin with, as we like to always in this context, with something of prayer. And it will be our habit every day in the morning, just to begin with one of the religious traditions offering a prayer from that particular tradition. That doesn't mean that everyone has to subscribe to the faith content, but at least, shall we say, share respectfully with the prayer dimension of the other. And since I think it's the only day that I get to open my mouth first, so I feel it, I sort of have this part of my lot for today. And as we're doing mystical prayer as our topic, I thought I would like to begin with a poem. A mystical poem composed in Safed in the 17th century by Rabbi Elazar Azikri, the author of Sefer Charedim. Most of you know the poem, most of you may have even sung it to the point that it's lost its flavor, but hearing it in English may give it new life. And I offer this as really, within these words, an aspiration both for the personal dimension of contact, of religious expression, and also for the larger goals of peace that ultimately come through the kinds of encounters that we are beginning with at this moment. Merciful Father, love of my life, draw your servant whither you will. Your servant runs, fleet as the deer, he bows down beholding your glory. To him your fellowship is sweeter than wild honey or any other savor. You, with whose glory the whole world is radiant, for love of you my soul is sick. Lord, I beseech you, I beg you, heal her. Show her but the beauty of your light. Then she will be strong again. Then she will be healed, knowing the source of everlasting joy. Faithful friend, let your mercies move you to pity the child whom you love. For all this long time I have longed, longed to set eyes on your glorious might. That only does my heart desire. I beseech you, have pity. Do not hide yourself away. Show yourself, I beg you, spread over me, beloved, the canopy of your peace. Set the whole world alight with your glory. Let us rejoice and delight in you. Tell your love quickly, for the due time has come. Show us favor as once in former days. This is what Yedid Nefer sounds like in English. What I'd like to do for the first session that we have set this morning is to let everyone have a bit of a sense of the teachers, of the presenters. We are missing one presenter who I will be a stand-in for, but because I'll only be a stand-in, I'll go last. What I've asked is for each of the lecturers or teachers in the summer school, in fact, with the rush of all things, I didn't get a chance to tell you this, right? So you'll either pick up on it or you'll let go of it. Okay, up to you. Okay, so I've asked just about all the lectures in summer school to give us a brief working definition of what they mean when they say mystical prayer, because in speaking of mystical prayer, in fact, we're speaking of many different things, of diverse phenomena. And we will be looking at different things. And that's why I thought both as a way of getting to have an initial sense of the teachers and of getting out in the open the different working definitions to ask everyone to share what, in 10 to 15 minutes, no more than that, a very brief working definition of how he will be using mystical prayer, so we can all come back together, then ask about that, query that, and look at that. Before doing that, I ask each of the presenters to say a few words about himself, okay? Who he is, where he comes from, whatever he wants to tell us about himself, so we have more of a personal sense, and then other participants will join us later. So since this is also part of introductions, let me also begin by saying a brief word about myself. I imagine by now all of you have figured out that I am the infamous Alon Goshen Gottstein, whose name you've seen on various posters around town, and that I'm, shall we say, one of the seven moving spirits behind the Elijah Project. Professionally, I'm amongst other things, also an ordained rabbi. I've taught rabbinic literature in Israeli universities for 20 years. I still do engage in that field of research as well. And over the last few years, I've felt a strong urge to establish this interfaith academic institute called the Elijah School. I'm not sure that this is the moment for me to give a lecture on the Elijah School. I just want to say that, therefore, that in a sense, you'll probably see me more disappointed and frustrated than anyone else around here. Everyone will be happy and I'll be frustrated. It's just in the nature of things that the person who tries to push the thing suffers. So bear with me and support me in this. And if you have any further questions, we'll have plenty of time for me to address them. Actually, before moving on to other presenters, I want to present to you my partner, the second of the seven moving spirits of the Elijah Project, who is co-moderator of this program, and I think the best thing is that he should present himself.
Okay. My name is Barry Levy. I have been teaching Jewish studies in North America for longer than I would like to admit. My original training is in Semitic linguistics. Like Alon, I'm also an ordained rabbi, and I've taught at Yeshiva University, at Brown University, and at McGill University, where I have been professor of Jewish studies since 1975. 2.5 years ago, I became the dean of the Faculty of Religious Studies at McGill. And in that capacity, I got involved with all kinds of interfaith activities in a way that my previous academic career had never really permitted or encouraged. Obviously, it permitted it. And so when I learned about Alon's efforts here in Jerusalem to build the Elijah School project as he had envisaged, I was very happy to, eager, I guess would be a better word, to see if there was a way to bridge the Faculty of Religious Studies at McGill, where we teach many of the world's religions, and the effort here at Elijah to try to get participants in these religions to actually share, not only to dialogue with each other, but to study seriously each other's religions. I participated in the program last summer. I'm back this summer with several of my students. And hopefully in the future, this relationship will develop even further. If you have any questions about McGill, I passed out this little newsletter. If you didn't get one and you like one, there are some more available. It does describe what we're doing together with Elijah, and hopefully next year's issue will have much more to announce.
I'm Harvey Egan. I teach at Boston College, which is neither in Boston nor a college. It's in Newton, and it's a university. I was ordained. I'm a Jesuit priest, ordained, I don't remember the century now. I've been teaching at Boston College for, I don't remember the century either, but it's over 25 years. My specialty is speculative theology, and also mystical theology. So I'm interested especially in the relationship between profound living faith and the meaning thereof. If we say, for example, we believe in the one God, what does that mean? What does that really mean? And I think the best place to look for an answer is the person who lives the fact that there is one God. All right. It's extremely difficult to define what mysticism and mystical prayer is. Bernie McGinn of Chicago University has already written approximately 1,500 pages, and he's up to the year 1350, and he's not through with the period between 1200 and 1350. I have an anthology of 55 mystics. And if you read the anthology, again, you will see that it is extremely difficult to define precisely what mysticism is and what mystical prayer is. But briefly, no Christian mystic, no Jewish mystic, I'd say no Hindu mystic, no Islamic mystic, no Muslim mystic, before our time, believed in or practiced mysticism, quotes, unquotes. What they did was to believe in and practice a concrete religion. So I see mysticism or mystical prayer as one element, or say many elements, of a wider historical whole, because any religion is much broader, has more elements, is more complicated than, say, mysticism. All right, so I'm speaking of mysticism and mystical prayer as one element of a concrete religion. And in the case of Christianity, I would define, by my working definition of mysticism, is it's really that part of Christianity's beliefs, its practices, that concern the preparation for and the consciousness of and the reaction to, the response to, what we can simply call or describe the immediate presence of God. That's what I mean by mysticism. In short, by mysticism, and it's a bit simplified, mystical prayer, I would say it involves a transforming awareness, direct, immediate consciousness of God. Just as husband and wife are directly, immediately, palpably present to themselves, to each other, I would use that analogy for the mystical life. Right. So I prefer to speak about the mystical life instead of mystical experience or even mystical prayer. I emphasize transforming because for me, well, as a Jesuit, our founder Ignatius of Loyola, he had a vision early in his conversion. He had this vision, and later on, it was about 40 years after the vision, he said, I know it was from God because it changed my life. So a type of consciousness that does not change one's life, I would say, is not mystical. All right. So I'm speaking about the transformative consciousness of God. Then finally, I would say that the Christian mystic is someone who is haunted by, possessed by, purified by, tormented by, illuminated by, in some sense, killed, right? Christian mystics often speak of a mystical death, a radical, a real death, right, to self. So the person is haunted, possessed, tormented, purified, illuminated, and transformed by God. It's like falling in love. Basically, it is radically falling in love, and all that that implies.
My name is Evgeny Torchinov. I am a professor of religious studies of St. Petersburg State University, Russia. And my field of studies is Eastern, especially Chinese religions, and first of all, Chinese Buddhism and Taoism. I teach at the Faculty of Philosophy of the said university, and some months before, we have established new department, Department of Oriental Philosophy and Cultural Studies, and I am a chair of this department. I am very interested in different traditions of Buddhism, especially Mahayana or Great Weak Buddhism, as it was represented in India and especially in China. Taoism, the so-called religious Taoism, is the second subject of my personal studies. As well, I am a member of International Buddhist Organization, Buddha's Life, Buddha's Light International Organization, BLIA, which was established in 1992. Its center is located in the United States, in Los Angeles, but its president is a Taiwanese monk, Venerable Master Xing Yun, and this organization represents tradition of the so-called humanistic Buddhism, engineer Ren Jianfujiao, humanistic Buddhism, Buddhism not only for monks, but for lay people as well. About definition of mysticism, I quite agree with my colleague that it is very difficult to define mysticism. There are several or many, it's better to say, definitions of mysticism. In the case of Buddhism, the situation is especially unusual, if it can be said. Buddhism, as I think you know, is non-theistic religion. And the concept, it is not monotheistic religion, non-polytheistic religion, it is non-theistic religion. And the notion of God isn't the central notion of Buddhism. And its main difference between Buddhism and such theistic religions as Christianity, Judaism, Islam, or theistic Hinduism. Nevertheless, I think that Buddhism is a deeply mystical tradition if we will understand by mysticism the way of transformation of our mind, of our consciousness, from the profound state into the sacred or liberated state. From the standpoint of Southern Buddhism, the goal of this transformation is the attainment of eternal quietude or nirvana, and deliverance from our sufferings of the world of birth and death, that is samsara. From the standpoint of the great vehicle or Mahayana, the goal of this path of transformation is to become a Buddha, that is enlightened one, through the realization of our inner nature, which is the Buddha nature. According to Mahayana, everybody is Buddha, but doesn't know about it. And this transformation, the goal of this transformation, of becoming Buddha, isn't personal liberation, but the benefit of all sentient beings. And Buddhism is very rich of different methods of mind disciplines, of contemplation, meditations, meditation. And in my lectures, I will try to present the most important Buddhist traditions of contemplation, of meditation, and of prayer and such. In Buddhism, we have different and very rich tradition of the so-called mantras or prayers with transformational attitude. And for myself, Buddhism as mystical tradition is a tradition of the way of transformation of profane, vulgar, non-enlightened state of consciousness of mind into enlightened state of mind, which is the Buddha mind. Thank you.
My name is Nilima Shukla Bhatt, and probably I am the least experienced teacher here. I am a doctoral student at Harvard University in study of religion, and my focus of study is cultural expressions of devotion in medieval South Asia. So I study devotional poetry in Hinduism and Sufi poetry, as well as Sikh devotional practices. I am at a stage where I'm ready to begin writing my thesis, and mysticism, mystical aspect is a central to all the poetic devotional poetic traditions in India. As far as the definition for mystical prayer is concerned, as both Professor Egan and you mentioned, there is no precise or comprehensive definition that would include all the mystical experiences in history. But I'll try to follow Louis Dupuy in his article on mysticism in Encyclopedia of Religion. Another term important for this is prayer. So I'll try to follow these two definitions from the Encyclopedia of Religion and give my working definition. In the Hindu tradition, the three aspects of mysticism which are predominant and are generally found in other mystical traditions is, one, the first is ineffability. The mystical experience is an experience of the transcendent, whether it is a divine being or it is the ultimate reality without form and without attributes. The experience of being close to that transcendent reality, most mystics say, is beyond words. It cannot be described in words. And that aspect of mysticism is common to almost all mystical experiences. The second aspect of mysticism that is central to all Hindu mystical traditions is a sense of transformation. And in the transformed state, a sense of passivity. The human consciousness is brought to a stage where the sense of I-ness, the sense of self, is dissolved into that transcendent experience, that altered state of consciousness. And either it is merging into a divine being, into God, or it is complete dissolving of the sense of self into an ultimate reality. And thirdly, there is a sense of integration. There is a sense of dissolving of distance when the aspirant or when the religious practitioner starts on the path of mystical prayer. There is a longing to reach that state where the self and the transcendent are united, and there is a sense of distance. But in the mystical experience, there is a sense of integration, that distance is dissolved. So these are the three aspects of mystical experiences in a variety of mystical traditions within Hinduism. Hinduism is a very complex network of many integrated traditions, and it has many mystical traditions, which I will be discussing through the course. But all of them share these aspects. Now coming to the next term, prayer. This is a means to reach any human act which is performed in order to, or with a purpose of reaching the transcendent state, that to have mystical experience is a mystical prayer. And it can be speech, it can be speechless, it can be an act of offering, or it can be an act of just viewing or listening. But it is a human act which makes an effort to communicate to the divine or to transform oneself to reach that transcendent state. So combining these two, I will give the working definition of mystical prayer as a human act of communication with the transcendent entities, or an effort to reach a transcendent state, which may be verbal or non-verbal, and which leads to the ineffable experience of union with the divine. So Within Hinduism, there are many forms of mystical prayer. There is mantras or chanting of religious verses. There are rituals and sacrifices. There are dances and songs. And there are also many, many different forms of meditation which can all be considered mystical prayers. And we will be discussing this in the course.
Okay, great. My name is Jamal Ilyas. I teach in the religion department at Amherst College in Massachusetts, the U.S., which makes three people from Massachusetts. And I've been there for 10 years. At Amherst, I teach pretty much everything to do with Islam and some stuff to do with I guess theory of religion. In addition to that, my research specialty is in medieval Islamic mysticism and mystical thought. And what I generally do, I do a variety of things, but what I generally do work on is how people tend to describe, to perceive, to codify, to interact with things that they by definition consider to be ineffable, indescribable in accurately in language, which is a term that has come up again and again about what we're talking about as being the mystical. So I work on that in several angles, and I also, in a sense, because it is related and I'll be talking about it in the course of these 2 weeks, I also work on Sufi poetry. Or Islamic mystical poetry. So definition of mystical prayer. I guess what I'll one advantage of going late is that I can say, you know, well, I believe what she said or I believe what he said. And first I say that and get it out of the way. But also, so I'll give first my own working definition, then because I am talking about Islam, sort of refer to Islamic definitions of these phenomena. For me, again, the point, of course, is that we're talking about mystical prayer, and prayer is one aspect of it that we can't forget. It's not just mysticism, but also the issue of prayer. And mysticism, I tend to agree with a lot of what's been said, that it is, I would just, as a working definition, tend to add and very emphasize the word perceived, in the sense of that it is what individuals tend to perceive as being their interaction with some transcendent entity of some sort. And so it's that aspect of religion which is, it interacts with something that is transcendent and definitionally indescribable. That doesn't mean that it is indescribable, because as a matter of fact, most mystics have a tendency to go on and on describing mystical experiences. So the issue really is the perception that it is definitionally indescribable, and that in itself is something that's very interesting. It's so that whenever it's so what they're trying to say, of course, I mean, again, they're not fools, so it's not just that they're caught in some kind of linguistic riddle of some sort, but what's at root here is that definitionally mysticism is something that has to be experienced and has to be learned through experience. One very common Persian Muslim metaphor for describing various forms of experience or learning, the difference between what they'll call analytic learning and experiential learning is that, you know, you can, if someone tells you, if you've never seen a pomegranate and someone says, you know, you say you don't know what a pomegranate is, and someone describes a pomegranate as this, you know, reddish brown thing, leathery on the outside. You open it up. I don't know what it's called in French or whatever, you know, so it's it. Okay. You open it up and it's got little red seeds in its place, and they look like garnet or rubies, each in a setting, and it tastes sort of sweet, sort of sour. You know what a pomegranate is, but that's very, very different from actually seeing a pomegranate bush
tree, whatever, it's shrub, and seeing its flowers blossom and seeing the little red flowers and seeing the pomegranates ripen and then actually picking one and holding it in your hand and opening it and seeing and, you know, tasting it. That's a very different form of knowing something. And so for mystics tend to emphasize the experiential as opposed to the learned in their religious experience, and therefore whenever they talk about it, that's why when they're communicating it through language, whatever language, verbally, music, anything, art, they're emphasizing the fact that their description is metaphorical, because ultimately you have to experience it. So that's for me the mystical. Then the second issue being the notion of prayer. Prayer is, again, I tend to understand it as something that is ultimately, it's ultimately a dialogue or a potential dialogue. It's a human being trying to communicate with God, either with the expectation of an immediate response from God or with the expectation that there will ultimately be a response from God. And this applies both to, you know, little prayers like, sort of personal and formal prayers of please give my family health, wealth, and beauty, plus sort of ritual prayer, which tends to be a little more impersonal, but ultimately there's some sense that maybe God doesn't, you're not asking for something immediately, but there's some contractual lifelong expectation that you will get a response from God at some point. So there's this communicative aspect to it. So for me, the combination of the two then ends up being that there is a mystical prayer, is again, it is a form of dialogue with God, and that, or whatever, I mean, and I'm speaking in an Islamic context, because obviously Islam is a theistic religion, so there's some entity on the other side that is only really understood, you can only understand that entity through some sort of direct communication, some experience of that entity, and that the prayer ends up being an attempt, it is that communicative element of trying to experience that entity. And since there is built into, certainly very strongly built into the Islamic notion of both of God, and particularly the Islamic, what we're calling mystical notion of what is God, is the notion that any description, any verbal description, any physical description is metaphorical. Ultimately, what that means is, ultimately, it's a lie. It's deceptive. That all of these, sort of the speech, the verbalization, ends up definitionally being a metaphor, a symbol for some underlying experience, communication with this, with some other entity. Again, I say this because as I'm talking, I'm just thinking that there's an entire spectrum, obviously, like in every other tradition, there's a spectrum of understandings of how these things work, and a spectrum of understandings or a spectrum of behaviors by which people actually try and engage in mystical prayer in an Islamic context. And as Professor Egan said, that there's, you know, he said it's like an experience of being in love, which is a very common metaphor that's used for mystical experience. Similarly, there tends to be, just as people who are in love have a tendency to write poetry, Muslim mystics have an alarming propensity for writing poetry and for setting it to music. And again, because there's at some level the idea that poetry rather than prose, music rather than not music, are really good ways of expressing emotion, because emotion by definition doesn't fit very well in descriptive sort of language. There's a very conscious understanding at some level of the role of speech and of metaphor in talking about the ineffable, which, you know, they do.
And this is rather cruel to fling this at me like this late note, late time. Okay, I'm Graham Harvey. I'm a senior lecturer in religious studies in Winchester in the south of England. I should say Old Hampshire and Old England in relation to the newer colonies. Oops. Winchester is in the chalk downlands of southern Britain, and I now teach within 20 miles of Stonehenge. And I was also born 20 miles from Stonehenge, but somewhere rather different to Winchester. So I now have the privilege of teaching in a landscape which is very important to me for reasons that you'll hear a little more about later. And I've now lived in that landscape about half my life, and the other half of my life I've lived in other holy lands, including the north of Britain, Northumberland, where I did my PhD in ancient Jewish self-definitions, thoroughly unmystical venture doing a PhD, and I have spent two, perhaps more mystical years in Israel, Palestine, the Holy Land, call it what you will, experience it as you do. Most of what I teach now is, well, there's some Judaism in there, but most of what I'm known for really is my work on contemporary paganism in the world now, a diverse series of movements of people whose spirituality is centered on the celebration of nature, tending to be very polytheistic, radically polytheistic, and typically very immanentist. So we keep talking about transcendence, whereas most of what I deal with is very immanent. So when Alon said, come along and join in, and the topic is mystical prayer, I said, no, we don't do that. But let me think about it. So I thought about it, and I really wanted to get my definitions snuck into my papers somewhere nearer the end rather than right out here in the open at the beginning. So I've been scrawling things as people have written. But I came to the conclusion that we actually do have a tradition of mystical prayer in what I am happy to describe as animist paganism. And I'll define those terms in my papers rather than now. And much of what's been said I have no trouble with. I'm very happy to agree with and share those perspectives on what mysticism is and what prayer is as an experience. I want to radicalize a couple of things, and I do want to challenge a couple of things. So the radical thing that animism brings to mystical prayer is that the language of being in love, what we're actually talking about here is sex. And that mysticism at its best is like good sex and good ritual. Most of us, that's where we get our most intense mystical experience for all kinds of reasons. It makes us sing, dance, it gives us a sense of unity with somebody else, a form of transcendence, but I'm saying in a very radically imminent, concrete, physical, embodied, relational way. So I want to take those poetic parables and midrash maybe and say that there's something more about the mystical experience which makes those references to the sexual encounter between the mystic and the object of their desire and take that very, very seriously. The object of desire for most animists is not some transcendent being that we cannot describe. The object of desire is those many living beings with whom we relate, with whom we are in relationship all the time. The other human people, the rock people, the cloud people, the tree people, those many people who we eat, as well as those who we have perhaps friendlier relationships with. So I want to then pick up again the word transformation and suggest that the transcendence within the imminent mysticism of animist paganism offers a form of transformation which is a demand for justice and action. So this is not a passive form of mysticism. This is an experience of our unity with the all that encompasses the many, all of us. But it's also a form of mysticism which celebrates the many and their desires and their need for life. And our modern world, perhaps postmodern, is radically threatening the life and well-being of the many, and therefore of the all. So what I want to argue in my second paper is that mysticism and mystical prayer should lead us into action and not into passivity. So I want to say that Rudolf Otto was completely wrong about mysticism in many, many ways. Finally, just a couple of words about prayer, since I suppose we have to try and attempt to define prayer. Prayer to most of us animists, again, is not really where we use too often, but there are many ways in which we express our conversation and our communication with the all and the many. And I will refer to one of those frequently, probably, which is the touching of a leaf. Just the very casual touching of a leaf as you go by a tree or a bush, a shrub. Especially when you know that as you touch that leaf, the leaf touches you. Okay, now that's really the same as a lot of other mystics would say. The other great metaphor, the other great mystical experience, is that of the breath that we share. So as we breathe in and we breathe out, in the practice of mystical encounter, so we're sharing the unity of all life. So those are the kind of ways I want to approach.
The interfaith meetings, I remember one of them in which the goal of the meeting was to come up with some kind of statement at the end of the day. So I wish to declare that I have no intention for coming out with an agreed upon statement on mystical prayer, that I have animism, Buddhism, Christianity and Judaism all agreeing on what mystical prayer is. So what I'm about to do now is just to pull out some strands that I would like to highlight, and then I will proceed to share a very, very dense email message I received from Mayor Sender. But if there's one word that probably came up more than any other in everything we've just heard now, it's transformation. And this is something to bear in mind, the importance of transformation as a defining factor as we listen to the different traditions. Transformation seems to emphasize the psychological dimension. It has been something experiential. And it seems to also have some dimension that's interpersonal, whether that interpersonal is between people or between man and God or man and nature. But there seems to be transformation with an interpersonal dimension. So I think this is one element that seems to be central, and I think we will probably be coming back to time and again. Another element that I want to keep in mind is the use of language, because many interesting things were said here about the centrality of language. We've heard about, first of all, the tension of, or the efficacy, or the possibility of addressing the goal of the mystical quest in terms of language. On the one hand, we've heard about the ineffability. On the other hand, we've heard about the need to express in ways that are non-linguistic, ranging from silence, sound, song, poetry, ways of breaking language and making it a vehicle for something else. So I just want to keep these just to highlight them as elements that have come up so far. Now, our absent presenter is Mayor Sender. He will introduce himself tomorrow morning. Let me just say one or two words about him, as he's also a close personal friend. He is rabbi of the Congregation of Young Israel in Sharon, Massachusetts. He holds a PhD from Harvard University in Jewish Studies, which is probably fair to say is usually equivalent to three other PhDs in view of the fact that the training program at Harvard usually lasts about 15 years. He wrote it on Rabbi Yitzchak de Minako, a 13th century, a 13th century Jewish Kabbalist. In addition, he is at present teaching at Brandeis University, teaching Kabbalah. And in addition to
the academic dimension and, shall we say, the pastoral dimension, he has a very keen interest in the subject personally. The field of Jewish meditation is a field that is, shall we say, very much in need and very open to different people coming in and doing different things. That is to say, in view of the fact that the contemporary situation has people exposed to other people meditating, in the last 20 or 30 years, there's been a strong felt need in the Jewish community to have a meditation. And people are constantly either seeking someone to teach them meditation or seeking different forms of meditation. Now, Meir has been very active in working through Kabbalistic texts on an experimental basis and an experiential basis, and leading small groups of people in meditation taken from those texts that he works on, so that he brings to the subject not only the academic knowledge, but whatever quest he has for personal experience behind that. I think the matter is clear, but I want to state it nonetheless, that all teachers here present are not only scholars of their tradition, but belong to that tradition and therefore are willing to speak for it in the first person. So it's for the Jesuit. Evgeny, I didn't make out, you said that you were the head of the Buddhist Society in St. Petersburg? Oh, you did say that, okay, because just then I was distracted. And Nilima comes from within her tradition, as does Jamal, and we've just heard about how important this dimension is for Graham. So that in fact we have the personal dimension in these conversations quite beyond the academic. Now, because Meir was absent, I asked him, he had an important function in the community on Shabbat yesterday, and therefore he can only fly out this morning, I asked him to send me a brief working definition of what mystical prayer is. This text is so dense that it would need him to unpack it. And I've been going back and forth between reading the text to you or just distilling some points from it. And I will read it to you. I can't say that I understand everything that is in it because the writing is rather dense. Obviously, it's one thing, you know, it's one thing when you're sitting in a room talking. It's another thing when you're sitting in your computer trying to condense it into two paragraphs. Okay, so the definition is the following, and I will try and elaborate on it a little bit. Definition goes as follows. Mystical refers to direct experience of divine reality. Okay, so we've got here this dimension of experience and, of course, divine reality. Prayer is an address and a calling to God in the expectation of a reciprocal relation. Now, not all our working definitions so far offered had this element of address and calling in a kind of reciprocal relation. In fact, the only one in the group of speakers who brought this element out was Jamal. All the others spoke of it more as a quest for the absolute, some sense of love, some transformation, but the simple dialogical element of address and the expectation of a response is very much highlighted in Meir's definition. And I suspect that it will become one of the points, I mean, I suspect, it's obvious already, but it's one of the points on which the traditions divide. That is to say, you may be able to agree on certain other things, but is there an element of reciprocal address in both dimensions? This is obviously one of the issues that will come up in our conversations. Now, putting those two definitions together, mystical direct experience of divine reality and prayer as an address and a calling to God, he then says, mystical prayer stands in an address and calling, which itself becomes the experience of the divine reality in whatever way it shows itself. Okay, so the mystical prayer is that address which allows us to mediate the divine experience. Practically speaking, mystical prayer is the realized experience of prayer itself, as aware and self-aware as possible, of the turning to address, the projection of the calling, the openness of the expectancy, the transforming reciprocity. As I said, this is dense. I'm just going to place it before you and let him unpack it. But you notice that many of the elements that we've had here, including the transformational element, come through in this definition. Yeah, when he says the transforming reciprocity. But of course, the emphasis is on reciprocity, and this goes back to a question that Dov asked, and which in a moment, as we open an initial discussion, we'll get to. Mystical prayer should be distinguished from meditation and contemplation per se. Meditation, whatever form it takes, whatever its methods, is a self-directed act of learning. It is ultimately an attempt at resolution to resolve the tension of consciousness, spanning the paradox of identity in the relation of self and other, by discovering a new ground of self, by continually undergrounding and regrounding the self. Meditation introjects the other, ultimately the other, into the self by effacing the self to greater and greater transparency. Prayer is an expression and projection of the self to the other. Whatever its forms and methods, whether it uses the realms of action, word, song, or thought, it attempts to span the same paradox by the projection and expression of consciousness. It also undergrounds and regrounds itself to greater and greater transparency, living and finding the other and itself in that projection. So if I get right what Mayor is suggesting here, meditation brings the other, let's say the absolute, into our consciousness. Prayer projects us into that. So what's important to note is that it was important for Mayer to speak in terms of, on the one hand, consciousness, transparency, but just also to suggest a distinction between prayer and meditation. Now, I raise this as one more point for us to keep coming back to, namely, to what extent is the distinction between prayer and meditation useful? For him, and I can understand very well why, and in a moment you'll see from Bill's question why, there seems to be a very strong need to distinguish between prayer and meditation. I'm not sure, well, this is certainly not true in the case of Evgeny, in a non-theistic context, but I'm not sure that this would be true for Harvey. And I suggest that we all go on first name basis rather than professors and the like. So I think, I'm not so sure that this would be true for Harvey, the distinction between meditation and prayer. I'm not even sure that, you know, South Asia there is going to necessarily agree with us. So it's important that Judaism seems to feel, or at least our Jewish speaker seems to feel the need to distinguish between the two, and this is something that we'll let him explain to us when he comes tomorrow. Why does he feel the need to distinguish between prayer and meditation? Final three lines. Both meditation and prayer are grounded in the nature of the intentionality of consciousness. Meditation reflects on the intentionality of intention itself. Prayer expresses the intentionality of intention itself. So meditation reflects, prayer expresses. Meditation swims upstream, pressing back against the stream to interject from the infinite. Prayer swims downstream, pressing forward against the stream to project toward the infinite. I prefer to not comment on this because it's someone else's text. I placed it before you very, very, very briefly with the understanding that there's more in here that needs to be unpacked. And what I'd like to do now, since we've heard so much, is to we have a little bit of time for discussion. What we need to do now is the following.
Normally at the yeshiva just close to this building, which is called Mokno Russia, yeah? It's a Jewish study place. And my question is regarding what you have said before. It's more of a psychological aspect. When you speak of psychological, it's not so important what you have on the other side. Maybe you have nothing. And if you don't really need it, you just make it disappear. So the thing in Judaism, we used to speak of something like acting on God, what's called theurgy, because it's very different from psychology. It's something, you can have some people in Jerusalem, a lot of Jewish people, acting on God, Kabbalist people, and they don't really feel something experiential. I mean, there is experience, but the most important thing is to act on the flows of God, energy on the world or something like that. And it's something, it's mystical, it depends what you include in that, but it's not exactly psychological. I'm a bit afraid of psychological, because if you say I'm psychological, you don't really need to have a counterpart. We can live without it.
I must admit, I find myself hard-pressed to answer you directly. So I'll answer you indirectly. I would definitely, as a Christian, understanding the Christian mystical tradition, be extremely opposed to a reduction of mysticism to psychology. All right? It has to do with the ontological, metaphysical reality of the human person and the ontological reality of God. We are dealing with the living God. We are dealing with the living a person. So I would not reduce a mysticism to some sort of psychology. Secondly, in the Christian tradition, the first maybe the first 1,000 years of Christianity. Mystical, the term mystical and not mysticism was used, that mystical meant the hidden sense of Scripture. Right? So the first quote-unquote mystics were basically a Christian exegetes. They were not exegetes in the academic sense. I have a friend who says there was no mysticism in the first 1,000 years. Well, it's absolutely clear that the early exegetes, it was a way of life. Right? Thirdly, in the mysticism of the first 1,000 years, there was an extreme emphasis on discovering the reality of God in the Scriptures, Jesus Christ in the Christian Scriptures, the Church. So it has to do with reality. Yeah? So I would not reduce mysticism to some sort of psychological state. So I don't know if that has answered your question. For at least the first 13 centuries, there's no distinction between the experiential and the philosophical or the theological. Yeah? You just don't find that. You need someone as intellectual as, say, Augustine, and we'll treat him this afternoon. But it's still Richard of St. Victor. You read the text of Richard of St. Victor, his writings, they are extremely philosophical and theological. There's a sense, of course, in which if you read the text, it smells of God. And the sense of God is there. And thirdly, I think I'll end with this. The Christian mystic is not primarily someone who is passive. I think a bit later on when we see some of the figures in the Christian tradition, for example, contemplation in action, the sense that the mystic has for God, and precisely because of the mystic's awareness of God, he or she has a greater awareness of neighbor. So love of God and love of neighbor are intrinsically united in Christian mysticism. And I would say, up to Graham, the Christian mystics also love the world. We can talk about the mystical senses, that they become alive, more alive to all of creation, even though some are world-denying, at least initially. You do find, you know, the emphasis on abnegation and so on. But more on that later. So I'm not certain if I have answered your question directly, but I would deny that Christian mysticism is essentially psychological. Because if it's essentially psychological, what is the reality to which I am related? Either on that end or that end. But more on that later.
Thank you, Lydia. And I'd like to ask you a question about the first question is, do you think that mysticism is a religion by itself? And the second question is, do you make any difference between a mystical prayer and non-mystical prayer?
In the Christian tradition, and as I understand Islam, and as I understand the Jewish tradition, one does not begin by saying, I'm going to become a mystic. Right? That one attempts to become a deeper believer, one who is more profoundly immersed, and say, transformed by one's own tradition. Secondly, I said that in Christianity, the mystical dimension is only one dimension of Christianity. You have the institutional. There must be a remembrance of salvation history, which is not always, I'll say, mystical. So I am not making mystical into a religion. I mean, definitely not. I'll just speak of Christianity. The mystical dimension of Christianity is simply, I shouldn't say simply, it is one aspect or one dimension in which what is stressed is the direct, immediate presence of God. The ineffable God, the God who is personal, the God who dialogues. But often in the tradition, you'll find the mystic speaking about being annihilated, dissolving into God, being nothing, absolutely nothing. That's not erotic. So you find the eroticism in, you find the eroticism certainly in the Christian tradition, but by no means exclusively. And I'll have more to say about that later. In fact, the advantage of beginning with Augustine is, since the middle of the 19th century, it was radically denied that he was a mystic. Yeah? And I'll bring up some of those issues this afternoon. I don't want to... Just briefly, the second question. It is common in the tradition to distinguish between acquired contemplation or some meditation and infused contemplation. Now, what I mean by that is, initially, the person in the religious tradition prays, takes part in liturgies, dances, has all sorts of ways of expressing one's religious beliefs. Gradually, one may speak of a special gift of God, so-called infused contemplation, in which the person, and this goes along with the definition that he sent in, the person begins to experience much more that one is grasped by God instead of one is trying to grasp God. And then thirdly, with respect to being grasped by God, if God is a God of love, if God is a God of, say, creation, then very definitely social action is required, say, love of creation. But I'll have more to say about that later. It's very complicated. It's strange.
In the course of various statements, people have referred to the association between mystical prayer and love or sexuality. And even though everybody didn't say it, I noticed an awful lot of eyes opened up at the comment. I'm curious if, in the course of discussion, whether now or at some time in the future, you would all address the following question, and that is, I'm curious if all the religious traditions, regardless of whether they are, in fact, completely, partly, or totally not in favor of celibacy, use that imagery the same way. And I'm also curious about, given the fact that it is claimed that sex, in fact, changes, attitudes towards sex change throughout one's lifetime as a result of biological changes, if this, in fact, affects the way in which the mystics understand the relationship between what they're experiencing and sexuality. In other words, is it more intense at one point in life? Is it less intense at another point? And is there a pattern that can be established in relation to biological developments, or is this totally unrelated?
At first, I would like to say some words regarding a psychological aspect of mysticism. In the Buddhist tradition, I think there is no principal difference between psychology, ontology, or theology, if the word theology can be applied to Buddhist system. One story. In the 13th century, one of the Vietnamese emperors, who was a strong Buddhist, was very abused of his political and other worldly affairs, and he left his palace, coming to the mountain monastery.
And the abbot of the monastery asked him, why did your majesty come here? The emperor asked, in the quest for the Buddha. And the abbot answered, no, there is no Buddha in the mountains and in the forest. The only Buddha is in your own, only heart. And beside this heart, there is no Buddha. You must to find this Buddha in your own heart, in your own inner nature. And from the most philosophical standpoint, one of the most important schools of Mahayana Buddhist philosophy, the Yogacara school or the Jainavada school, proclaims that all three worlds of samsara are but consciousness or mind, it's nyapti matra. And in with such attitude, there is no principle difference between psychology and the inner work on transformation of psychic, of mind, and some mystical movement through different levels of the world before of some principle in one principle unity of consciousness and world. And the second, and some of Buddhist monks, especially from Chenyo Zen tradition, were very iconoclastic wise. For example, sometimes they even destroyed statues of the Buddhas or holy scriptures. Why? You mustn't think that this statue made of wood or metal is the Buddha, is the absolute. No, it is only image. And the real Buddha is your own inner nature. And you mustn't think that the letters of scriptures are the words of the Buddha. The voice of your own nature is the only real voice of the Buddha. And the second question between the difference, about the difference between mystical and non-mystical or simple prayer. I think that within the frames of my definition of mystical prayer regarding the Buddhist tradition, there is no real difference. Every real prayer or contemplative practice has its transformational meaning. Certainly in the folk Buddhism, in popular Buddhism, there are some very simple non-mystical kinds of prayers. For example, some people can pray to some bodhisattvas, to some holy beings about their worldly profit, their worldly success, but it isn't the Buddhism proper. In the Buddhism proper, every meditation, contemplational and prayer activity, prayer practice has its mystical or transformational dimension. Thank you.
Question regarding the distinction between mystical and non-mystical prayer first. I think as far as the Hindu tradition goes, any prayer by definition is mystical because it is an act to communicate with the transcendent, or when I see transcendent, I want to clarify this in response to your discussion earlier. And transcendent does not necessarily mean, in the Hindu tradition, something beyond. It is very much here also. And the concept of Brahman, which I will be discussing later on, is the concept that there is an underlying reality to everything. All that exists is Brahman, is the absolute reality, and therefore all that exists is sacred. And in that reference, I would like to read just a couple of lines from a popular Hindu prayer, which will give some idea of how here and now is approached. Thou art everywhere, but I worship thee here. Thou art without form, but I worship thee in these forms. Thou need no praise, yet I offer thee these forms and salutations. So it is very much, and so the psychological dimension that we were talking about is not so much going beyond this world, or not going or leaving this phenomenal world or disregarding it, but it is making a shift in how to see this phenomenal world and to see the sanctity of what is here and now. And in that sense, if here and now is also sacred, even those prayers which are made for well-being of the worldly life is mystical, because it leads ultimately to union with that underlying absolute reality that underlies everything that exists.
What was your name? Michael. Okay. And Barry, you had mentioned something about to address the issue of sexuality versus phases of life, etc. So on the issue of mystical prayer versus non-mystical prayer, and whether or not, you said the other part was, is mysticism a religion? Well, I think one thing that has been said again and again is that viewed from within any particular tradition, we'd be hard-pressed to argue that mysticism per se is a religious category. It's not something that they thought of themselves as mystics. And so, historically speaking, I'd have to say that there's really no such thing as mystical prayer per se. There are certain forms of prayer that we can identify as mystical, others we can identify as not being particularly mystical. And by my definition, yeah, there is a distinction. The kind of prayer in which I say, oh God, please let me win the lottery, which I don't know what it's called, Lotto, I don't know if they have one in Israel, that's not a mystical prayer. However, it is a prayer in the sense that I'm trying to communicate with my conception of God and expecting that God, hasn't worked, but expecting that God to let me win the lottery. But that in itself is not mystical. I feel I can make a distinction between mystical and non-mystical prayer. The other issue is mysticism a religion? I think in modern times one could argue yes, in as much as one can identify a group of people who see themselves as not in sort of a new age spirituality, seeing people who feel that there is some version of reality that they believe in, which they all share. And I think, in fact, the whole notion of comparative mysticism is built on the premise that underlying religions, there's some inner truth, which is the ultimate religion, which for me personally, to be quite honest, is a very problematic notion, because I find it very difficult to say, oh, well, person A is saying X and person Y is saying, one person is saying this thing and the other person is saying that thing, but ultimately they're saying the same thing, which means that they're
both of them are intellectually and linguistically inferior to me, is what that ultimately means. I understand what they're saying better than what they do. Then that I find extremely problematic. I have to take them at their word. So I find that notion of, is there one mysticism, very problematic. The second question, which is sort of independent of that, the whole notion of sort of sexuality versus, you know, what would, you'd want it, it was... Yeah, in an Islamic context, there's several different understandings, I guess, of these things. There's a deep, generally, celibacy is, as sort of a lifelong endeavor is not valued in Islam, because sort of family life and social organization based on some kind of family unit of procreation is very highly valued in the religious community. But simultaneously, there's also a deep-seated respect for not so much asceticism, although asceticism as well, but abstemiousness, from refraining from things. And so anybody who refrains from things that are perceived as being physical pleasures, be they, you know, living well, eating well, having a family, that's seen, that's valued, it's very highly valued at a social level. And so there tends to be, there invariably, historically, you'll see that in Islamic societies, anybody who's identified as a, or most people who are identified as being religiously very powerful or important, spiritually powerful or important, tend to have been valued for an ascetic streak in them as a person. This is, and it's always identified in that person. And the second issue being that of celibacy. Celibacy is generally, it's valued as sort of, again, in terms of stages of life, is quite common. And so there's a sense that once most people who are sort of Islamic mystics, Sufi bigwigs, they tend to, when they, for a major part of their lives, be sexually celibate. So the commonest pattern actually is that they fulfill some kind of familial obligation. Another very common problem, because a lot of these people were from a social elite, which meant, you know, because education, access to education was an elite endeavor. And so, you know, they provide for their families, and frequently you have the deeds of, you know, and they did this and they did that and they did that piece of land here and that. They provide for their families, and then they have the leisure of living an abstinent life. But on the other hand, Ibn al-Arabi, who's died, I guess, 1278, who's the most famous and possibly most influential Sufi figure of all time, Ibn al-Arabi was perhaps celibate for small, you know, he was celibate between sexual encounters, basically, was his life. I mean, you know, he's actually very interesting in that sense, because, as you know, he had women as teachers. I mean, well, this is not necessarily sexual, but it's unusual for Sufi masters, major Sufi figures, to have a large number of women as teachers whom they mention extensively. He sort of had this, he'd marry and then leave and move, because he sort of traveled from Seville to what's now Turkey over the course of his life, and lived in various places and was involved with these Sufi women. And again, as he's not a model of celibacy by any stretch of the imagination, but in any way.
The question of celibacy and erotic love will come up again and again in the Hindu tradition, because there are these two trends, both of them equally strong in the Hindu tradition, where erotic love or sexual love is a major metaphor for love for God in all the devotional traditions. And at the same time, there is also a strong trend of celibacy and abstinence in the yogic traditions. And so these questions will come up in the discussions through the course next week. Thank you.
in Buddhism, in monastic Buddhism, standard monastic Buddhism, celibacy is very important part of monastical practice, but in some trends of Buddhism, such as Vajrayana or Tantra, the very libido, sexual energy, was used through different techniques of its purification or transformation as a mean for self-realization. And we have very interesting mystical imagery of the Tantra tradition using very developed sexual imagery. And I think that this theme of erotic or sexual imagings in mystical tradition and attitude towards celibacy and sexual life is also rather important for understanding of mysticism and mystical attitude towards life and towards religious practice.
Thanks. I find this very enlightening. I hadn't thought we'd get into mysticism and sexuality quite as much as this quite so early, but I think it does. The two things are related: the psyche, inner, and the sexuality. I'm intrigued by whether the possibility of sexuality changing throughout a person's lifetime makes a difference in their understanding of or their experience of mysticism too. And I haven't thought of it, so I'm not going to make any statements on that one. I'd like to go back and talk to people and see what they come up with and learn more from this couple of weeks here. But somewhere in one of my papers, I've got an OHP slide that says something like, I have a problem with psyche because the Western Enlightenment has insisted on the psyche being something inner, self-reflexive, and that we're having a conversation with ourselves. It's begun to be much more like an ego trip, and I could use other rude words for that, but won't now. But I prefer the word soul here because the way we use the word soul now includes earthy, gutsy, sexy things like food and music, soul food, soul music. And I think that there is this inner sense in mysticism clearly, but the Western discourse has taken it too much within, whereas my suggestion that mysticism is like good sex was meant to be part of that discourse of the soul engagement, and very clearly about reciprocity too, that good sex here should be about reciprocity and not about an ego trip, and maybe that's part of this going through a lifetime, that perhaps, I hope, sex gets better because it is more reciprocal, more engaged, more an encounter with the other, and in that sense, more of a discovery of our real engaged self. But that's to be worked on. So those are vague sort of thoughts that I think are kind of linked, but maybe they don't come across that way. And to me that answers the question about whether mysticism is a religion. And the answer is very clearly no. For me, mysticism is a tool by which I, as an academic, and we as Western people generally, or people engaged in Western discourse generally, try to explore these things. And the problem is we tend to try and make them into neat, boxed categories rather than rich, engaged experiences. So mysticism is not a religion, nor is it a single, clearly defined trend within any single religion. But we use it as a tool to explore aspects of maybe all religions, maybe, I'm not sure. And it's a bit like we use religious experience because we're afraid that as religious studies experts we might lose our jobs if we don't have something within, sort of mystical, that the scientists can't, or the sociologists and others can't just say, well, that's why they're being religious, it's all about capitalism, the rise of Protestantism, all those things, yeah? So we grabbed onto this. It's all about inner experience. Real religion is inner experience. Well, it isn't, is it, really? It's all those other things that people do. So mysticism is not only like and not like good sex, it's also like and not like good ritual, which has also been ignored in Western discourse. But I'm sorry, that's perhaps not what you're asking, just one of my own obsessions about the problem of these terms that we use to try and explore these things. So I think I'd better hand the microphone on.